This is Radical Love Live, an ongoing series of podcasts and special events where we explore faith outside the boxes. Hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson.
Hey, Kelly.
Hey, how are you, Mark?
How are you?
I'm very good.
Good.
So good.
Just laugh because I actually usually say awesome. So I am actually awesome, not great, but so, awesome.
I'm very good. If I was any better, I don't know, I'd have to write a poem.
Oh, my goodness. A short poem or a long poem?
Probably a long
one. Long poem. Okay, right on. Great. Kelly, what are we doing on this episode?
We are continuing our conversation with Jeff Key, who is our friend, and as he's a Whitman fan, and he contains multitudes. He's a writer and an actor, playwright, poet, former Marine, Iraq War vet, activist, world traveler, and
philosopher, I preacher. I accused him of being a mystic on the last conversation.
Anyway, welcome back, Jeff. It's great to have you back.
Very nice to be with you. Enjoying the visit.
Thank you, Jeff. All right. You have, in the first episode, and I'm going to say this to our listeners, if you are skipped past the second one, I'm sure you'll get plenty out of this, but make sure you don't miss the first episode. You get to hear Jeff talk about his faith from point A to point B, and boy, has he got some ups and downs and lefts and rights in it, which I think all faith journeys have that, right? Yeah, it's just the way it goes. So I got a quick question for you. You mentioned your pastor there at Church of Christ.
Did I get that right?
Yeah. In the documentary, Semper Fi, that's about your life based on, well, actually about the journals that you wrote while in Iraq. I'm looking for his exact quote. He said that your lifestyle is contrary to what God teaches. And in my view, it puts his soul in jeopardy. And because I love Jeff and I'm concerned about that and pray for him, especially he felt because you weren't repentful. Now, I get all that, but I love how you were in the last segment talking about a call to love, and we were discussing former President Trump. I think that's where we left off. But you said you have a deep love for this man, and I could see how. So tell me a little bit about that relationship with that pastor, the Pastor Bud, right?
Yep. And if anybody in the Church of Christ is listening, they would get me for not saying our nomenclature around preachers is a little different. He was always Brother Bud instead of we never called him Reverend. And he was our preacher. And they considered, I think, the elders of the church to be, which were some four or five dudes, to be the pastors of the actual church. I don't know. There was a lot of kind of debate about things among those denominations back then. But Bud came with his family, and when I was in the, I think it was the summer of the sixth grade year, he had a son my age, who's actually probably my first love. Jeff wasn't gay, but he was my friend, but I also loved him. I can look back now and go, that would have been, it was about the time when you're first, whatever. But we were friends, and his younger child, a daughter, Ginger, is still my good friend. She lives still back in Alabama, and we visit from time to time. I'm still in touch with her, and I loved both of her parents. They both since passed away. Their mother, Peggy, was very supportive of me without ever, I don't think she ever said the word gay to me or whatever, but I certainly wasn't closeted to her, and she just exhibited loved me, that there was no judgment in it. And even when, I'm so glad that people got to hear, because preachers who believe that homosexuality is an abomination to God get cast and talked about in one sort of broad brush. And he says it right in the interview. His concern is because he loves me. And according to his belief system, it puts my soul in jeopardy that I might go to hell because of this. Because I'm not trying to change it or have God change it anymore, any of that. And that's a lot different than the people who stand out with the bullhorns, berate drag queens or whatever. But yeah, I think it's very positive the way, and he had rather me change my mind or change my sexuality or whatever. And I would have rather he changed his mind about that. Just come to some other, my dad was in my wedding. My dad's a Church of Christ deacon. And even before legal marriage, we had a ceremony that my fellow service members stood up with me, and Joan Baez sang Gracias a la Vida, very fancy. Our parents, my ex Adam's parents and my parents were in the wedding. So I know that they came to a piece about my sexuality from the very first night that I told them after three double scotches at age 23 that I was gay. They treated my partner as if they wouldn't have treated a daughter-in-law any better. Yeah. He was always welcome in our home, and no one ever, I understand that's not everybody's story. And in the same way earlier when I said that the Lakota will give someone of my genetic heritage a pipe to carry in their tradition, the fact that my parents treated my male partners the way they did speaks to me, to their conviction of faith and what God, how God manifested in their lives. And yep, I love Brother Bud. And you know what? I would have preferred that he believed differently, but really I don't need to change him at all. Maybe if somebody could take if Christians who would have heard him say anything else couldn't have quite gone there, but they could see the loving nature with which he thought about it. I didn't need to change a thing in the world about Brother Bud. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. I asked for that specific reason. Again, for the folks that have not seen your documentary about your story, when he is interviewed, you could see he's genuine about his love for you. And it was coming from his own conviction, as you just shared, which is separates him in how we, our wish for folks to understand what our lives are like as queer folk is you're asking somebody to walk in our shoes, which is impossible a lot of times. And that's just the reality. But love is love is love, which kind of goes back in a very circuitous way, coming back to the Donald Trump thing that we were talking about in the previous episode. About you mentioned how you look to understand how you can love him. Maybe you can talk a little bit more what you even share that in the documentary about love and your belief. I think you have I don't want to take words out of your mouth, so maybe you should describe how you see love in the world.
Boy, people do their PhD dissertation on what it is. There's definitely so many different words for love, depending on what kind you're talking about. And ultimately, what we feel when we say we feel love is we're biochemical little machines. But with romantic love, there's some mixture of serotonin and cortisol. That's why it feels love can be terrifying to that. As far as in the spirit of the question, I think, and what we're talking about is when it comes to someone like Donald Trump, and yes, I believe he is doing great harm. I believe that his ministry, and he has a ministry, if for them to spray the Black Lives Matter people, no matter what believe about that organization or their cause, like when I grew up, God was the most important thing in the world, but it wasn't a close second. And Brother Bud talks about that in the documentary, is love for this country and freedom of speech and the words, the sort of freedom and democracy and liberty that are etched everywhere on the marble halls, I take them super seriously. And I believe that it's dangerous for people to believe things that allows us to act in ways that, now I sound like Brother Bud, but if that were true, that I believe is in contrary with the highest and best for all of us. Like that takes food from the hungry and denies health care for the sick and all the things it seems like Jesus was up to, that if people can get emboldened in their behaviors that are counter to this very obviously what's best for all of us, not just best for the ones who are suffering, but best for the ones, because the most soul sick, I was a hooker in my 30s in Los Angeles, and I would go up into those hills, into these houses with men who had, I remember there was a man who had an Oscar as a doorstop. It was his sort of fatalist, dark joke about its worth or whatever. And they were lonely. They had everything that this world had said you had to have. Money and influence and awards and accolades. And Jim Carrey speaks something about that. He wishes everybody could have got what he got so that they could realize, I'm willing to give it a whirl. But I think I'd be a very good rich person. But progress, not perfection, comes to mind. And when it comes to loving Donald Trump, yes, I do. I love this man, and I don't love much about what, I don't love anything that I can think of right now that I've seen him do. But if that, I don't forgive necessarily because, no, I don't forgive because of what it does to or for or around the other person. I forgive because I don't want to live in bondage anymore. And I know what that bondage feels like. And I know myself well enough to know the things I do to try to soothe immeasurable amount of pain that I live in when I'm walking around just beholding all negative behaviors of other people. I'd rather live with a philosophy that let me square away what's on the inside of this skin. And when I get all that done, one might argue I would ascend then, but then I can start fixing. Now, I get to forgive him. Walking on water is a pretty good trick, right? I've not pulled it off. Water to wine, you could probably at least be a favorite party guest. But I think the greatest miracle in the story, whether you believe the historical Jesus happened or not, just in the story, was to be actively being tortured to death and to say, forgive them for they know not what they do. Yeah. Actively, the title of your show, like it was radical forgiveness to be tortured in this way that's, let's face it, even Mel Gibson's version, not accurate to what a brutal, how this species has been, this brutal, they use for entertainment way of murdering this guy. And he's saying, hey, Dad, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know. So when I get really pissed, when I went over the river yesterday to go try to find me some doors for my truck, and there's Trump's flags are flying everywhere. I did have a Black Lives Matter sticker on the back of my truck. And I'm aware that people are seeing it and they don't like that. They don't like a white, gray-bearded dude with that and like dangerous. Like they would kill me, given a chance, because they're so embattled by what Donald Trump is saying. He stood there and said, we got to fight. We got to fight. They're stealing us. We got to fight. And then he went and stood in the White House and watched while they carried the Confederate battle flag into my capital, into our capital, something that didn't even happen in the Civil War. He watched an active attempt to overthrow our form of government through violence and could have stopped it at any instant if he's as powerful as he says he is. He's the president. He could have stopped it in an instant. Tell him to stop. This is not what I meant. He didn't. He stood there and watched it. He watched it because he thought maybe they would be successful. But there is nothing about my saying, I love him and I must forgive him, that says I have to forgive that behavior or that I have to let that behavior go, that the laws of this land are very clear on that sort of thing. And that if we're going to live, we're going to agree to all the sign onto this constitution, and everything, then. And we've now talked about all the things you're not supposed to talk about at a polite dinner party, but
yep,
I love him. I forgive him. I would never want to meet him. I don't want to be in his presence. I've been as an activist, I've been in the close physical proximity of some high level politicians who are his highest supporters. They smell like fear. It's so sad. It's so sad. I took the hand of Lindsey Graham outside of his office and I just wanted to have a conversation with him. If you go on the Views YouTube and put in Lindsey Graham veteran, Whoopi Goldberg and Meghan McCain go at it about me for 10 minutes. Cause I really just want, I needed Lindsey Graham to explain to me, you're a Southern man. And we grew up, I guess we're about the same age. He's a little bit older, maybe, that we grew up being told these same things from similar pulpits. And we both say we believe so much in the principles for which that flag stands. I believe that Donald Trump is not fulfilling the oath that we all took. And he scurried away like a little rat. He scurried away into his little hole. It's biblical. It reads, I've done every sin that you can find listed in the Bible, but I'd rather that have been true and seek forgiveness or be humble about it or honest about it even than to do what the political moment there that we're in reads a lot like biblical times, you know, that people roll their eyes when you say, but it really does. When the governmental structures and religion to control the minds of the masses start working together in this very nefarious way that causes all this suffering to God's children, then something epic's going to happen. it's just unsustainable. And it's sad because I really do love my country, especially just having traveled to so many other places outside. And generally, we've been very popular around the world, given some of the stuff we've done. Not that we've not done great things, too, but I'm the grandson of a World War II sailor that fought the Nazis in the North Atlantic. That was a good thing he did, my daddy Shell. But you can't rest on those laurels forever. And eventually, without our allies, we cannot function on a global stage. And so hubris, as it's talked about in the Bible, is expressed through our governmental leaders. If you care about the country, then you'll be vocal about that, because we cannot continue marching on doing what we want and expect people to rally to our side time after time again. And as big and bad as we are, we got the nuclear arsenal to do it. We can blow the world up, but we can't stop bad guys by being this standalone America first celebration of anti-intellectualism. Sadly, it seems that we've become. I don't want to be negative, too negative, but I do want to be, I have a lot of fun in my life, but I think these are very serious times.
I have three bracelets on here today in honor of this interview. One of them is from Evangelical Christian Organization. The other one is an American flag, and the other one's a pride flag. Thinking about your story, and I put all those together, I know that your story is really wrapped up in being a patriot, loving the United States. And these days there's this kind of rash of Christian nationalism, of people who are putting together Christianity as a theocratic way of wanting to run the country. And I was wondering if you had, what your view is on Christian nationalism, those that are mixing the two.
That it only exists out of ignorance. People don't understand. My brother is a very good man. I love him. I have one brother, and he's super involved in his children's lives. He's doing his best to do a good job as a dad. And his kids go to public school, and a few years back, they bought this big blow up thing for the football players to run through when they come out, very motivating, whatever. And he put a cross, right? So the last thing they see as they run through is this cross, which for most people in Walker County is their religion. And his thinking is good. His heart is good in that. He wants them to pray that everybody has a safe game and to rely on their relationship to God to show them how to succeed at goals in life, I presume. That's all that. But I said, it's a public institution. If you care about our Constitution, then religion has to be kept out of. If there's a Jewish kid that runs under there, or some kid, and he's just, I don't care, it's Jesus is Lord. And that's not okay. We can just, the beauty of our Constitution was drafted by slave owners and ultimately used to emancipate slaves. So if you want to make it that, you can. Very scary. They can do that. We can go on now. Donald Trump could become president again, and they could say, let's switch over to it. They tried to make George Washington the first king of America. We want that, right? And he was like, no. You better believe if the whisperers told Donald Trump, you know what? Let's have you be King Trump the first, and then your successors can, they could pitch that idea. He'd absolutely support it. Like, we could become a monarchy, the essential idea that our country was founded on to depart from. And I believe there's enough support for really bad ideas, then it happens. Your bracelet tour. When I did this play, The Eyes of Babylon, based on my Iraq journals in lots of places around. I was protested in Backwoods, Kentucky. It was great. They had little flyers with my name on it, and we don't want a guy here. And I was all over, and I was often in Washington, D.C., knocking doors. I didn't care if it had an elephant or a donkey or whatever on the door. I'd be like, I'm Jeff. I'm a Marine. I'd like to talk to you about the war I served in. And if they talked to me, I would. Republicans and Democrats let me come in, and I talked to them about my beliefs. Mostly, I was leading from what is safe and best for America point of view. And because I'm a veteran, would try to keep their focus on a measurable amount of self-destruction, slow and fast suicide that happens among veterans. My mother's a social science teacher, and she really believed, she was a true believer when it came to that flag and what it stands for and all. And she wasn't naive either. She knew that we'd made to have a most any enterprise in life, big or small, the ones that are super, super successful in the end are the ones that have made the most mistakes, because you have the opportunity to grow and do better. But I went to look at the Supreme Court building just because it means so much to me for the vast history of humanity and how we resolve conflicts and how just off with his head or whatever, and how he got to this thing, and fallible as it is and dangerous as it can be, it means something. And so I was there and I was just looking, and there were a bunch of young people there praying on the step, and they were praying to end abortion. It was before Roe v. Wade had been turned over. And they came up and they noticed, I guess, probably my choir reflection or whatever. And they're like, "How you doing?" And I was like, "Good. What are you doing?" I said, "I guess I'm praying. I'm praying for our country and for the people who live here and the people who are affected by decisions in there." And they're like, "Oh, great." Like I said, I forget where we were. We were about to open the Eyes of Babylon. And so we did it in 9 cities around the United States and in Ireland somewhere. And I said, I wrote a play based on my journals from Iraq that I perform it, my way of bearing my testimony. It's I tell the people my story and they can do with it what it is. And they go, "Oh, can we pray with you about it?" And I was like, "Absolutely." And so I believe that the government should stay out of a woman's uterus or whatever. I believe that her health care is a decision she gets to make with her doctor, and that let's just nature or God or whatever has given her that. Let's just let her do that. When we fix all the government problems, then we can maybe start meddling in other people's lives. But I believe the opposite of what they were there for. They wanted abortion to be illegal in America. But these young people stood around me and they prayed for the success of my play. "We thank you for his service. We thank you for his trying to help other veterans." And then we all amen together and I left. And they don't necessarily know all the rest of my story, but their prayer was in earnest. And if there's power in prayer, and I do believe that there is. I was on an airplane not too long ago, and it was on some Patriot holiday. And before we took off, there was an old feller. We were leaving out of New Orleans, old feller on the front row, proudly sporting his veterans hat, old black dude. New Orleans, predominantly black culture. And the flight attendant says, "Oh, you're a veteran. I think it was Veterans Day. Happy Veterans Day." And she says, "Tell us your story." And she keyed the mic and gave it to him. And he had gone to, I think he went to Korea. He went to Vietnam and he got back, and you got to think of the South that he came back to. And he's I liked it better in the military, so I went back in. He told his story and he gave her the mic back. And I looked at the guy next to me as an airman. He is all similarly aged, older gentleman who has on an Air Force. And I said, "We're good. He's a soldier. If the captain had the fish, you can fly the plane. And I'm a Marine, so if there's any terrorists on board, I'll take care of them." And she heard me say it. And she goes, "You're a Marine?" I said, "I am." She says, "When we get airborne, I'll give you the mic." And I was like, "That's my dream." Like, they're talking about a captive audience. Well, the terrorists here got to listen. So what I told them was, like, in this country, if all those people that we've been naming that believe so differently than we do, I don't believe in genocide, but I don't believe they should have to leave the country. I hope their ideas will evolve. They hope mine will. They hope I change my mind. I hope they change their mind. But since, you know, for the most part, that's unlikely, what we have to now do is share the land. We have to live here together. We have to share what we have. So I said to my captive audience in the airplane, I said, "Just do me a favor. The next time you find somebody political or social or religious beliefs or vastly different from yours, as soon as you find out, say, this Marine talked to us on the airplane and he asked me to do this favor because I get thanked for my service all the time. It feels good. My standard answer is, may it continue, because I do believe I've done a lot more for my country as an activist and an artist." But I said, "The next time you find somebody who you vehemently disagree with, say, let's just stop right here and let's find something that we absolutely agree on, you know, that we like, the schools need, whatever. Old folks deserve respect. And then go together to the old folks' home that Saturday and just hand out muffins, or go by and say hello and just shake hands with those old people who never, that we've all forgotten, or go plant some trees together. You may believe climate change is real. You may believe climate change is the biggest hoax in the history of humanity. But if you both think trees are good, go plant one together and just make a commitment for that day not to talk about the issues that divide. Because that was the real thing behind Don't Ask, Don't Tell. They did not want a boy from Sunbright, Tennessee, or some inner city hip-hop kid, which in the 2000s, hip-hop was so inordinately homophobic. The last thing they wanted was him in a fighting hole realizing that I was not there to try to have sex with him, and I would give my life 1,000 times to save his. Because after that experience, he goes on and he lives his life, and he votes, and he spins in a way that reflects that. When his kid comes in with a faggot joke at 14, he'll be like, hey, you check that stuff. Your Uncle Jeff would have died for me. And real change happens. A positive change happens. And I'm not belying. I hate when gay people like trash talk gay pride and all of it. I get it. I find some of it so very cringeworthy. And a lot of what's going on right now around gender and all, it makes me feel like a really old man. But the changes that need to happen, which really we can mostly agree on, are going to come a lot quicker if we can discover in each other our common humanity and allow ourselves to do what is the most fearful thing, which is to be vulnerable.
So true. What a valuable word, vulnerability. In this time that we've shared together, powerful story, Jeff. Thank you so much. There's a few references you've made to what I know through my own experience through AA when going through 12-step. And I love the phrase that you use about progress, not perfection, and making amends. Now, the reason why I bring that up to you is not so much, I'm not asking about your backstory here, but there's a philosophy that I got to learn even in my sobriety and dealing with all the stuff I had to deal with, that there is a better way in which to have a life. So I think what I do with this show or other projects that I'm involved with, that's really the message, is like to your message about finding that common humanity and that we're all sharing this existence as equal souls. My point to you though, the question is, how did you, was it your experience in the Marines that got you there with this philosophy and this wisdom that you have? Where does that come from?
I don't know if I'd go wisdom.
Well, I think you can use that word.
I pray to have wisdom. I do. If above anything I've ever prayed for, I pray that God gives me.
Yep.
Probably my chief fear is that I'll lose my faculties. William James writes about, there's a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience.
Yes.
And he basically talks like, there are the white light moments, Saul on the road to Damascus. Mm-hmm. You hear about people seeing Jesus in the door and in the clouds and where Jesus shows up, or the virgin bleeding. Mine has been of the educational variety, and may it always be. I feel like if we have skin on, we're not done. And so I guess the most honest answer to that question is through pain. I've found out so many times, I think that honesty is of paramount importance in all relationships, especially the relationship with the self. I have the rune Tewaz here, the Nordic rune. I told you I gleaned the wisdom of a lot of spiritual traditions. Mm-hmm. For the god Tyr, he's the god of war. He's the warrior god. I say a prayer that's written to Tyr, acknowledging that the enemies that I want to defeat are hubris, self-pity, judgment, all those, and it makes sense to me. But when you do a rune casting, when you draw this rune, its admonition is that the battle of the spiritual warrior is always with the self, always with the self, because people will show up. You've seen it over and over. If you got a really bad husband, wife, girlfriend, whatever, it's a disastrous thing. People that go through that, glad she got rid of him, and then the next guy is just same guy, different ball cap. We cast these people in our dramas so that we can try to resolve some kind of ancient hurt I got to where if I've moved forward spiritually in any way in my life, it's been because I was in such anguish. I don't drink and use drugs at all anymore. I used to drink Jack Daniels like it was water, and because it was a painkiller and I was in an inordinate amount of emotional pain. I had everything I believe wholeheartedly that I heard in the pews of the Church of Christ about the nature of God, and for that matter, the nature of Jesus, and that had been pulled out from under me. When I went to war in Iraq, everything that I believed about what was good to be a man, to be a Marine, to be an American, was pulled out from under me. Like I had nothing to stand on except my relationship with my Creator, which, you know, in my waking moments this morning, because I'll call it the Kunkashila is grandfather, Onchi is grandmother. Sometimes I use those terms interchangeably, but my favorite Lakota term for God is Wankantanka, which actually means the great mystery. The first line of the Tao Te Ching is the Tao that can be named is not the true Tao. So as soon as you're zeroed in on what you know, I think the smartest words in the English language are, I don't know. The more I use them, I don't know. I don't know. I've gotten to where I am because what I didn't work. On the hour and in 6 minutes, it'll do it. If I'm like the Muslims, if it's not absolutely convenient to do it where I'm doing, I can stack it off at the end. But 10 minutes every hour, I have a little alarm on my phone. And the physical part of it has been a little bit modified while I'm healing with my cardiac issues. But I do 10 push-ups, 4 yoga postures, 10 air squats, and I say a prayer of surrender. A very kind of familiar, formal one that you might be familiar with. Another one that it just essentially says, I messed this up every way it can be messed up. I'm now willing to say that there is no part of my life that I don't willingly surrender to your care. I'll row, you handle the rudder, please just help me row strong. And that way, all I got to do is the next right thing in front of me as best as I can, be forgiving of myself. The reason I did all this, in the absence of drugs and alcohol, I went to Amazon one-click shopping or Pornhub or just the fantasy idea of a different life. I can go off into Fantasyville and just live there instead of doing what I wouldn't even say that addicts and alcoholics have a corner on this market, but how many people are able just to sit with discomfort, to say, just being over there, like the French just don't believe in air conditioning. And I'm just saying, I can blame even my heart condition on the French. So as soon as we feel a little bit uncomfortable, we go and change it. We're a little bit hungry, we go eat, and we don't eat enough to satiate the hunger. We eat enough till we feel like gorged out, puppy belly full. Yeah, I got here by failing. I got to what I have right now by failing. And some of the things, I want to acknowledge this, like a good friend of mine, probably my smartest friend, said, no matter how wise and smart you are, it is highly improbable that you're right about everything. And so you go, oh my God, that's true, right? You got to admit, even the smartest, they got to be dead wrong about something. And I believe what I believe here, sitting here in this chair today. I go, wow, what is it? I really believe something that I am dead wrong about. I'm dead wrong. Until last week, I thought All Quiet on the Western Front was written about World War II. Spent my whole life thinking that. Never knew it was from the German point of view. I just heard this thing. I would have believed you if you told me Hemingway wrote it. I didn't know anything about the real thing that what All Quiet on the Western Front is. I'm so glad I know now, because it's about perspective and looking from a different point of view. Before I forget, I want to make a little plug. There's an organization called Black Elephant, and it's a not-for-profit kind of thing. And I was doing some of them in Europe, and I do them online too. There's a Zoom version I do on a Tuesday. And what we do is we get a bunch of people in a room together, or a Zoom room together. And for an hour and a half, we don't talk about politics and religion, the opposite of what you and I, right? We go around the room and we do a brief introduction about where you come from and how basically your presence of mind that day. And then we answer two questions. And the questions will be things like, what's an embarrassing mistake that you can now laugh at? Or what is a smell that always evokes a positive memory? Or when was the first time you had your heart broken? And honestly, I've sat in these parades with like members of the royal court and Google AI scientists and Rothschild bankers and activists and sex workers and students and cowboys. And we don't comment on what people share. They share it in 2 minutes. And we were talking about vulnerability. It's people on this unbelievable level and people who are like captains of industry and then people who've just been recently homeless come 2 feet in and do this thing. So if you go on blackelephant.live, it's not like a Facebook profile or whatever. It's basically a way you can get the information how to join the Zoom one. They're in English, French, and Arabic right now. But I would be remiss if I didn't plug that, because there is no panacea for the problems that we've discussed today and the problems that face the world. But there are things that work. And if we can approach them with some humility and just not stop trying, then there's yet hope for humanity.
Very well said. Very well said. In the time that we have left, tell us a little bit about what you're doing currently and going forward. You shared already about your journeys this past summer with the Peace Pipe. Well, what else is going on with you?
I landed in, there's that prayer alarm. So I'll say it. I'll say, dear God, I have made every mistake there is, trying to run it my way, and earnestly, humbly ask that you take control of my life, and that there's no part that I think I'm better at running than you. Just show me what the next right step is and give me the strength to do it. And if it's your will, let me help other people along the way, because I believe that's your will, because I feel so good when it happened. I believe that's a gift from you. And these things I pray in your name. I always say, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. My plan was, when I got back to Europe, was to go. My friend has a farmhouse in Nebraska, and I was going to go write this TV series.
Oh,
I have conceived of a TV series that I think, they always say, write what you go. Who was it? I think Toni Morrison said, go look for the book on the shelf, and if you don't find it, write it. This is a series I've not seen, and I really need to before I go. I plan to do it there, but after
Can you tell us anything about it?
Anything? I've talked to a lot of writers. The writers will come up and say, oh, I have an idea. And they start, and I'm like, wait, stop. Because yeah. I believe if you tell it with your mouth, you won't tell it with your pen. I can say that I'm made of Alabama clay, and the water of the Black Warrior River flows in my veins. The soundtrack of my existence is cicadas and tree frogs. That it's very much set in the Southern Gothic world in which I grew up, with magical realism, because that's the way my brain works. And Michelangelo does walk out of the wall and talk to me in my world. In the same way that MASH made it safe to talk about Vietnam by setting it in Korea, my play called, I will tell you, my screenplay for television is called Suffern, Alabama. Suffern is it's a fictitious town named for the crop that was once grown there when the rest of the nation was struggling financially. It was a boom crop there. But when they discovered that it was dangerous for human health and dangerous for the environment, they banned its cultivation. From there, we'll pick up and tell the story of this town in Alabama, Suffern, Alabama.
Okay.
Obviously, the triple entendre with Suffern. Now that, and I'm landed here in New Orleans, my truck and a few possessions were here, I'm mindful of the clock. And so I came back here to get my truck. I got my old redneck truck that if I won the Powerball, I'd be driving it the next day. I sold all my possessions like 3 months ago. I didn't save anything because it was sentimental. I saved a few things because they were sacred. My grandfather's World War II dog tag. I have an autographed copy of To Kill a Mockingbird, in which she wrote, for Jeff Key, good luck in Hollywood, Nell Harper Lee, Christmas 1999. So I figure if Harper Lee said to me, good luck in Hollywood, that is some kind of powerful prayer, and may her prayers come down on Suffern, Alabama. Yeah, I've been to Monroeville, Alabama. It's a lot like Suffern, I think. But I'm going to go on out. Everywhere I've lived except for New York City in the last probably 20 years, I've lived there by accident. I didn't expect to go there. And I have some very good friends who live in the San Francisco Bay Area. And when they found out about my heart thing, they said, we have a downstairs apartment. with its own bathroom and kitchen, it'd be a great place to write. Come here, let us take care of you, and you can write. So Tuesday, after I get the air conditioning fixed in the old truck, I'm going to point these wagons west. I got to go get Walt Whitman and Ruth Bader Ginsburg with some friends in Alabama. So I'll swing that way and get my two kitty cats. And then for the most part, I do have to just take a short little trip back to France in October because I am now officially ordained, thanks to my friends, Raphael and Amory, who've asked me to officiate at their wedding. I'm going to go marry these couple of people in Chenonceau, France, probably butchering it. My French will get better between now and then. As Oscar Wilde said, I will join those people. He said that I'll paraphrase. He said, whenever anybody goes missing, they're said to be seen in San Francisco. These are people who've disappeared into San Francisco, at least the coming months. So, really appreciate your inviting me, by the way, too. I know that what we've talked about today will touch people and that their journeys will be helped by it. And yeah, I just wanted to say, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh man, this has been such a great conversation. Yeah. We really appreciate you taking the time to share your experience with us. And we've just really had a great time.
Yeah. Jeff, thank you very much. Godspeed to everything that's happening with you, man. You are truly making a difference as well. That's what we're all called to do.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Radical Love Live, co-hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson. All rights reserved. You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, and other popular podcast platforms. Go to radicallovelive.com to learn more about us, watch recordings of our live events, and listen to our podcast. We also invite you to check out what Kelly and Mark are doing by going to our websites. Find Kelly at kellywilson.com and Mark at markdilcom.com. This is Radical Love Live, where we explore faith outside the boxes.